Well, as we turn this evening to a seemingly out-of-date chapter to shed light on some of the most up-to-date issues of life and our world, let me explain why we're doing it. You know, when people come up and say, Hugh, what do you think about ecology? What does the Bible have to say about sexuality? What does God think of economic justice? What do Christians make of personhood and relationships? We need to understand, though we're not going to get the last word on those subjects in this series, I hope we might uncover some first thoughts on them, at least some first Christian thoughts. And if I'm going to learn to think Christianly about issues, then I've got to begin not with the topics themselves, but with our God. And most of us don't tend to have the time and the patience to go that long way round, do we? We've kind of got the question, we just want the answer, and then we can live with it, or not. So this series heads back to seemingly out-of-date chapters to capture God's eye view of our world. And Genesis 1 is a great place to begin if you want to know about God. Indeed, I've called the first part of this talk tonight the God of Creation. The God of Creation. Because if you can look at this chapter unencumbered with all the questions and the baggage that we usually bring to it, that's the emphasis of this chapter, the God of Creation. When you look at it, you see that the way the chapter's put together means that God is the dominant figure. Almost more so than the creation itself. Statistically, the God word appears at least 32 times in 35 verses, with more than a dozen personal pronouns referring to him as well. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. And God said, so God made, God called, and God saw it was good. Derek Kidner said, to read this chapter with any other thought than God as your primary interest is to misread it. And actually the rest of the Bible continues this emphasis on the who rather than the how of creation. Another writer said this. He said that the author of Genesis would not, I think, have been terribly interested in our debates about the time scale of evolution or the physics of the first 3 minutes. They're not the questions he's asking. And it's why we're so often disappointed when we come to Genesis 1 asking them ourselves. Now, of course, there's more to say than we'll have time to explore tonight, but by any reckoning, this is a pretty thin scientific manual, isn't it? I don't know if you've realized it, if you read through the book of Genesis, the life of one individual, Abraham, takes up more than 12 chapters in the Genesis book, but the world is put together in a single chapter of less than 2 pages. The author seems to have little interest in the mechanics of creation. But then his silence there only furthers his real emphasis. The God of creation is the God of power. Look, verse 3. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. Or verse 9. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and the dry ground appear. And it was so. And God said, and it was so. It goes all the way through the chapter, the God of power. I once spent some time in one of those Central Asian states, and I was shown the most impressive street in the capital. It was the road that led from the president's residence out in the countryside right through to the president's palace in the center of town. I was told that the president said, we'll put the road there. And that's where it went. They knocked down any houses in the way, and he built it. Actually, the president, of course, never touched a shovel. He never drove a bulldozer. He was far too powerful for that. He just said, we'll have a road. And it was so. If you ever meet the person with the shovel, or the person at the controls of the bulldozer, you can be almost sure that they're not powerful. If you said to them, look, couldn't we just sort of move the road over there and avoid that house? They'd have to say, not me, mate, you'll have to ask the boss. Now, God didn't do it with roads. But look at verse 14. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. And he couldn't describe God's power more effectively, could he? The God of creation is the God of power, and he's the God of purpose. You notice how that this chapter is pregnant with purpose? Deliberately put together to make that point? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the word created carries the implications of from nothing. Which, by the way, states the mystery. It doesn't solve it. The nothing in verse 2 is a formless, empty, dark something. And we trace its progression day by day through the chapter as we watch God at work. Light comes into play alongside the dark. Sky above is separated from water below. Land appears alongside the sea. And then each of these is filled as creation becomes ever more complex. Light and dark get sun, moon and stars. Sky and water teem with birds and fish. And the land is populated by animals and humans. Nothing's seen as accidental. It's all very intentional. And God said, and it was so. That sense of order is very significant. Steve Fuller is a sociology professor at Warwick University. And although he describes himself as a secular humanist, he acknowledges historically how religion has motivated people to study science. This sense of order means there's something to explore and investigate. We don't have a random chance world. Because if we did, then science couldn't tell us anything. We wouldn't have science as we know it today if it weren't for monotheism, he argues, reeling off references to Newton and Mendel and their belief in divine plans. Dawkins says, he goes on, meaning the Oxford professor Richard Dawkins, who's just done a Channel 4 series attacking religion and entitled The Root of All Evil. Dawkins says, Fuller comments, Dawkins says religion is the root of all evil. Well, even if that were true, it's also the root of all science. Professor A.N. Flew, the atheist professor, who shocked his followers a year or so back by his switch to at least a vague theism, says he's persuaded by an inductive argument from the order of nature to a God, as he describes it, its intelligent orderer. And this sense of order and purpose is reinforced by the other refrain of the chapter. And God saw that it was good. He doesn't tell us what God's purpose is, but at each stage of creation, he checks his handiwork, nods, ticks the clipboard or whatever. It fits my purpose. Good. Even the end of the account continues this sense of purpose because it ends not with the creation of humanity, but with God taking a holiday, resting. As if to say there's more to God, there's more to reality, that there's more to life than just this creation. The God of creation is the God of power and of purpose. And when thousands of years later John starts his gospel by echoing the opening words of Genesis 1, in the beginning was the Word, it's of course quite deliberate. Through him all things were made. And as we watch the Word become flesh and walk the pages of history as Jesus of Nazareth, John's pointing from the start to the figure of power, to the one who knows the purpose behind the universe. No wonder he's saying all the time, we must listen to him. The God of creation. But if we take Genesis seriously, I wonder if we realize how that shapes the way we look at our world. Because you see, the second thing I want to talk about is not so much the God of creation, but the consequences of a creator. The consequences of a creator. Where all of this leads us. If we think of Genesis 1 as we have, it's not hard to see that it can't just be left at the beginning of time. It affects so much of how we're to think and relate to God, to life, to the universe. And there's just time tonight to kind of take the lid off three or four particular jars and have a little peep in. It's all we can do. But, I mean, why don't we start with the personal? These are each areas that the Bible develops in one way or another. Let's begin with my place in the universe. Chris Wright spoke of this in his immensely helpful sermon last Sunday morning, and we'll see more about it next week. But notice the right humbling that such a creator brings both to powerful people and weak people. You know the story of the American president. I forget just which one it was, but his habit used to be last thing at night to step out onto the White House lawn. If he had a guest with him, he'd bring him outside, and they'd just stand there and look up at the sky and the stars. And when they'd looked up there for about a minute or so, he'd say, "Right, I think we're small enough now, we could go to bed." Well, few of us, I suspect, have the dangers that are linked with being the most powerful man in the world. Many more of us perhaps know the despair of feeling ourselves the opposite. Some obscure cog in the vast mechanism of the universe. We can perhaps associate more with a Job. That figure with calamitous sufferings who spends the time with his friends debating with him his rights and wrongs, the justice and injustices of all he's going through. And if you ever get to read the book, you'll find it's chapter 38 before God speaks. But it's very interesting what he says to them as they sit trying from their position to explain all the meanings and the purposes. Listen to what God says. He starts with questions. "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? Have you ever given orders to the morning? You think you can explain all that's going on?" Job's left reminded of his ignorance. But not ignorance in a meaningless or a random world. "Surely I spoke of things I didn't understand," he admits. But he also says this, "I know you can do all things and no plan of yours can be thwarted." You see, for Job, the Creator puts him in his place. And it's a humble place. But it's still a place where he can have confidence in a purposeful God. And Jesus wears Creator's shoes. When he says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest." You will find that ultimate purpose. You will find rest for your souls. Or move from the personal, my place in the universe, to the broader canvas. Think of what Genesis 1 tells us about a multi-faith society. We've been discovering this week, haven't we, that it's a far more complex idea than we often glibly imagine when we trot out the phrase. There's nothing modern about a multi-faith society, by the way. I'm sure we realize that. Genesis 1 was written for just such a world. It may only be a single chapter, but this creation account is exhaustive, isn't it? "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array." Or as John put it, "Without him nothing was made that has been made." See, when you've taken on board Genesis 1, there's no room for any other gods to get in on the act, is there? Genesis 1 doesn't leave vacancies for territorial gods or tribal gods. You can't confine this god to a particular group. Here is the Westerner's God. Now, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Actually, far more than any attempt at a scientific manual, Genesis 1 is a polemic for a multi-faith world. One writer put it, the author of Genesis 1 shows that he was aware of other cosmologies, other accounts of the beginning of the cosmos, the universe, and that he wrote not in dependence on them, so much as in deliberate rejection of them. And you'll find that's an idea the Bible takes up all the way through. I mean, if you're making notes, just note down Isaiah 40 and verse 25. Here is God speaking to a multi-faith world, and he says this, to whom will you compare me? Or who's my equal? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name because of his great power and mighty strength. Not one of them is missing. A friend of mine flew into a country in the Far East not so long ago, and as they were coming into land, the plane showed one of those video promos for that particular country, and one of the lines it had on it was this, "Welcome to the land of a thousand gods." My friend said, as I heard that, I just began to think, where do they fit into Genesis 1? In the beginning, God. In the beginning was the Word. And fit those two together. And see the Word is Jesus. And you begin to understand why he can speak so strikingly, can't you? I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Let's take the lid off a third jar. What you might call spirituality. Because where religion is out, spirituality can still be in these days, can't it? And there are all kinds of spiritualities, and they do not all fit with this God of creation. I mean, a spirituality that looks for God within us, the God in you, has not read Genesis 1, has it? Hasn't read of the God who is outside of us. He is the creator. We are simply creatures. A spirituality that treats the body, the world, as evil or to be despised, it's turning its back on the God who made them and declared them good. There is a false asceticism that poses a spirituality. Everything God has created is good. And nothing's to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. That's what Paul wrote to Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 to 5. Worth reading. I've had this book on my bookshelf for many years, at least I thought I had. Of course, whenever you want the book, you discover that's the one you lent to someone and you can't remember who and they can't remember you lent it. Though I normally put my name in the inside cover in case it's you. It's called The Death of a Guru. It's the story of the conversion to Christ of Rabindranath, I knew I shouldn't have attempted it, Maharaj, who comes from strong Hindu roots. And he describes his father in the opening chapter. It's very striking. Listen, because of the vows he'd taken before I was born, not once did he ever speak to me or pay me the slightest heed. For 8 long years, he uttered not a word, not even a whispered confidence, to my mother. He's someone very special, the greatest man you could have for a father, she would say. He's seeking the true self that lies within us all, the one being of which there is no other. Sitting in the lotus position, toes of both feet turned up on top of the knees, on the board that he also used for a bed, he passed his days in meditation and the reading of the sacred scripture, nothing else. So completely had he turned within to realize the true self that he never acknowledged any human presence, although admirers came from miles around to worship him and to lay before him their offerings of fruit and flowers, cotton cloth and money. No one ever aroused a response from him. He seemed to be in another world. We'd move the God figures in the family altar tenderly, unwrapping them from the soft cloth, then covering them again, bathing them, clothing them with great care and reverence. It was like that with my father too. Like the gods in the prayer room, he did nothing physically for himself. He was a god to be taken care of, washed and fed and changed for 8 years. My father had followed Lord Krishna's instructions about giving up all attachments to position, to desires, to the physical realm. Very powerful, isn't it? Very striking. Worshipped as a god after 8 years of doing nothing. It's quite a contrast, isn't it, with the spirituality you'd expect to come from the God of creation we've read about in Genesis 1. Spirituality which has the scope to enjoy the world that God has made, to care for human physical needs. Not every spirituality does. To have as its hope not the physical nothingness of nirvana, but a resurrection body in a new heaven and a new earth. Well, let's take, if you've the energy, one last jar. Let's take the lid off materialism, shall we? For Genesis 1 speaks into that world too. I mean, come, keep yourselves active. Turn over to the New Testament, to Romans chapter 1. And see the apostle describing a world that is struggling and confused because it's lost track of this God who made the world. We've only time just to dip in at a couple of verses, but he explains why ours is responsible failing. Verse 20, chapter 1, verse 20, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power," we've seen that, "his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." But what's our response to that? Well, look at verse 25. "They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen." They worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Well, verse 25, there's our fascination for horoscopes, isn't it? I have the latest statistics I heard. It was a few years back now. 80% of people read them. More than 20% take them seriously. Remember going to Blackpool, great holiday resort in the north, and there I found the sort of wonderful 21st century mix of superstition and high technology. There was the board offering me your horoscope by computer. It's the star maker, not the stars, who rules our destiny. We don't need the signs of the zodiac, but the God of creation. He made the stars also. Here's a warning for us, and we'll see more about this later on in the series, when it comes to issues like ecology and conservation. We don't respond to the urgent, serious issues there by worshipping Gaia, Mother Earth. We respect nature because God made it. We do not reverence nature as if it were God and inviolable, as John Stott once wrote. But here, too, is the fallacy of the atheistic materialist, who believes physical matter is the only reality, that it's been reorganized over time, whether by Big Bang or some other process. And here, if you read through Romans 1, it is all the confusion and the turmoil that that viewpoint inevitably brings. Because life is meaningless if we're to be consistent atheistic materialists. You and I are simply the product of chance and necessity and time. We happen to be human. I guess we could have landed up as fish or stone. And life's immoral. without morals. So there's no good working in oughts and shoulds. Behavior might be conditioned, but that's not moral. Now, some acknowledge that. The behavioral scientist B.F. Skinner, one of his works was called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Rightly so. Because if you're an atheistic materialist, we can't have freedom and dignity. The Oxford professor Richard Dawkins speaks of the selfish gene. There's an honesty in their approach and a consistency, but it's far from attractive. Some of you may read Robert Crampton. He writes regularly in the Times, and his articles are often kind of a light-hearted veneer with a serious tone underneath. Just before Christmas, he wrote a striking article about, it was ostensibly about his son, who's 8, rising 9, and he still believes in Santa Claus. And Crampton goes on, "This worries me. I'm a rational man. I don't embrace mystery and magic, and I recoil from blind faith. I don't buy the Hollywood idea, peddled incessantly at this time of year, that we all have to keep a little of the infant in our lives. I'm not superstitious. I'm not religious. Christianity? Yes, to the hymns and the ethics. No, to the theology, the mythology and the metaphysics. The Ten Commandments? Marvelously efficient basis for personal morality and social control. Jesus died on the cross for our sins, mystifying and offensive. Heaven and hell? Hell no. Heaven? Useful holding option to soften the blow of mortality. Hamsters, grandparents, victims of natural disasters alike." And the article goes on, though, you see, to wrestle with the fact that how come he hasn't been able to tell his son there is no Santa Claus? And he feels guilty about that. He'll have deep discussions with him about physics and so on, and yet he can't tell him about Santa Claus, and it's almost as if he can't actually explode to his son either what he would put on a similar level, the myth about God. And so he ends like this: "I suppose one more year, one more day in truth can't hurt. Sam will be in my godless, empirical, rational, factual world soon enough. He almost is already. And while it may well be the way the world actually is and should be, I'm not saying it isn't a little bleak. Life is meaningless, and so are you. Come and join us." Doesn't sell well, does it? It's why so many atheists both admit you can't have morality and purpose and yet keep arguing for them. Have you wondered about the confusion of a world that can protest passionately, even violently, at the selfishness of economic materialism? You can't have a G8 summit without massive policing and protection, can you? We'll protest passionately about economic materialism, and yet we keep on embracing the philosophical materialism that gives rise to it. Extraordinary contradiction. We've got a world that warms to a Jesus who says, "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of his possession." And yet that same world would scratch his head when Jesus says, "This is how it'll be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God." Well, there's our confused world. For the vast majority, Genesis 1 has long been removed from any book of life. And yet we're left struggling with the bleakness and the confusion that comes to try and bring some meaning and value and attraction to a world without the God of creation. For all too many a Christian, I fear, Genesis 1 remains in our Bibles. But it's locked in a time bubble. It's restricted to explaining a long-gone era, the beginning of time and space, and its consequences are ignored. How do we know the joy and the freedom, the value and the purpose of a universe and a human life anchored in the God of creation? My prayer is that this series starts to bring those things home to us. And our final hymn is a prayer that that light, the light of a creator world, would shine more clearly in our world.